Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back, folks. Today I'm bringing back as a guest for the first time in a while my friend Brad Lammensdorf. He is a portfolio manager for the AdvisorShares Ranger Equity Bear ETF. That's a mouthful. That ETF is listed on a New York Stock Exchange under the symbol HDGE, appropriately enough, being that it's a bearish-oriented hedge fund. One of its distinctions in 2026 year-to-date, we're recording this on the 4th of June, Thursday, is that while the S&P 500, based specifically the Spiders ETF, they're up about 11% in this manic stock market bubble that we're in 2026, and yet this bearish-oriented hedge fund is up also for the year, about 4% through today. And that's because, unlike a lot of these passive ETFs that just short an index and with no thought about it, Brad picks his spots. It's an actively managed fund, and you're going to hear him in just a few minutes, among other things, discuss the areas in which he has been making money and seeing further opportunities to make money on a short side despite the bubble, and really paying not a whole lot of attention to it as far as the portfolio of HDGE is concerned. Now, certainly, like yours truly, Brad sees all kinds of danger signs out there suggesting that perhaps with little warning and very abruptly, we'll see a lot of the nosebleed areas of the financial markets start coming back down to earth. Like me, he thinks that the Treasury yields are a big potential headache to all of this. We also talk about the energy situation and the fact that the markets are ignoring the consequences, which could last longer than people want to believe, of this energy shock. They're ignoring the fact that the inflation and interest rate picture are not all that rosy, but there's still a lot of liquidity, there's still a lot of wishful thinking. So again, the reason why his fund has been successful, and he's been successful, is that he doesn't try and fight this momentum out there of the AI stocks and the Mag 7, no matter how dopey all of these things are. He's looking for the soft underbelly of the market, kind of related to Main Street. And among the things you'll hear him talk about are acutely the simmering credit crisis underneath the surface, whether it's commercial mortgages, where default rates are, as you'll hear him say, as high as they were in 2007 and 8. Private credit is not in good shape. Consumers are not in very good shape. So there are areas there of the bottom part of that K-shaped economy that we have where he's been able to pick his spots and make some money on the short side. Apart from that, as always, you know, he'll keep a heavy cash position if he doesn't like a lot of what he sees out there. But he's biding his time, and he's demonstrated yet again in 2026 that he's a very astute manager. And this is the reason, folks, why HDGE is my single largest recommended holding of any ETF or stock in the National Investor. And real quick, before I bring on Brad, make sure that you look at the notes to this podcast, because I will have the specific website for the AdvisorShares Ranger Equity Bear ETF. There's a lot of background information there, a fairly recent snapshot of Brad's portfolio. He and his partner John DelVecchio have done, again, a great job in managing this and in doing pretty well when a lot of bearish strategies are underwater right now. And Brad, I'm glad to have you back with me here on Your Money Today. It's been a good time, really, for you in relative terms to most other strategies to short the market, where the bears have been getting run over with this buy, baby, buy attitude that's been infecting Wall Street. So you're up, and we're recording this Thursday afternoon, you're up around 4% year to date. The Spiders are up about 11, but most everybody else short in the market is negative. So your active strategy is relative terms, had you do pretty good.
Yeah, no, we've been able to take advantage of a lot of the subsurface weakness. In any bull market, there's always, a layer of names that aren't doing particularly well. Over the last few years, it's actually been very pronounced. The relative strength has actually kind of helped us a bit just because it's a lot easier to see, the stocks with lower relative strength starting to fall off and where to start shorting. So it helps with the timing a lot.
Yeah, and that's been, those who have followed the market marveled at just how thin this AI led, and sometimes it trickles down to the Mag 7. Hard to believe now we're talking about the activity trickling down to the Mag 7 out of the AI stocks. But we even saw some of that today. The Broadcoms and a couple others get hit a little bit. But that benefited the Dow. I think the Dow, of course, also is up as an index because of yet again the 114th time during this Iran war where people want to bet on the war ending, or at least a ceasefire being extended. But under the surface, it's been pretty pronounced that you've had a lot of instances, and you've sent me some of these charts where you've had record 52-week lows on days that the S&P has hit a new high, and same for the NASDAQ in some instances. So there is an awful lot of weakness underneath the surface that you're able to capitalize on.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. I mean, we've been short AutoZone. We've been short a lot of the cable stocks. So there's, clearly there's things bouncing along with everything else. But, for us, when the markets are at their high, like this, there's always stocks that aren't participating or that maybe they got beat up and now they're bouncing on light volume, which gives you another opportunity to reshort them. So, for an active player, it's actually a very good environment.
Well, for sure. And I want to get to some more of those nuts and bolts down the road. But first, I want to back up a step, Brad, and look at the macro. I mentioned before you came on that you and I have traded occasional messages on the Treasury complex, particularly your target prices for TLT, which is the main Barclays ETF that the markets follow. And I, for one, have been rather amazed as we've gone along that we were up over 4.5% on the 10-year Treasury note. We've been over 5 on the 30-year Treasury bond recently. They've both come off of that level a little bit. But I would never have expected, if you told me 12 or 18 months ago that we'd be at these levels and the stock market would be where it is, I'd say you're nuts. You need to be in Happy Acres. But here we are. Why is it, in your view, look at the big picture, that the stock market has stayed so high, at least the indices, the major indices have, when we've had these run-ups in the interest rate complex, when the market is grudgingly coming around to the idea that there's not going to be any rate cuts, certainly anytime soon either?
Well, I think that when you start looking at the end of 2026 and seven, especially 27 and 28, you're starting to see the earnings estimates just ratcheting up because of this AI phenomenon with inside of the complex of the earnings forecasts with inside of different companies. My opinion is that while that may be occurring somewhat, that back in 2018, 2016, 2020, there was a lot of debt that was created. And it
Right.
was created at a very low interest rate. So a lot of that paper was 5 and 10 year type paper. So a lot of that's coming due now, including the United States of America debt. And so you've got a tremendous amount of paper not only rolling, but rolling to a higher rate. And so that's a tremendous amount of supply that's starting to come about that needs, a home. And I just think that the overwhelming amount of debt rolls that are occurring are not only going to shave margins unexpectedly, it's kind of like one of those things where you're like, well, of course we had a bad period. Who thought rates were going to go up 150 basis points on the long end? Well, if there's one thing that life should teach you is that nothing stays constant, right? You nothing's going to stay constant. And I just feel like that people are underestimating how much the long end can move up. And by the way, I mean, in the 90s, like we had a 6% long end. It wasn't the end of the world. But I think to get there will create some pain, it will create some angst, and it could shake the tree. And I think that's a very something easily that could happen.
Well, and clearly, I think the markets still are not priced for that environment. There's this incredible Pollyanna-like attitude that, well, Trump has got his man Kevin Warsh coming in now, and he's going to cut interest rates down to nothing. He's going to change the inflation formula to justify it, etc. And yet, here's a guy, I'd love to get your opinion of this, 'cause I've done a few interviews recently myself saying that, Warsh has got a few interesting policy items up his sleeve to try eventually to deal with the long-term debt, with getting interest rates down and so forth. But first things first, he's got to put the bond vigilantes back on the sidelines, or else he and Trump and everybody, all of us, are in trouble if there's
Well,
this
I mean,
unchecked rise
before
in yields.
3 to 6 months ago, he was talking about absolutely starting the tenuous process of selling out of the Fed's Treasury. I mean, can't be good for the long end,
No.
you know. So I don't know. I mean, and by the way, I think that no matter if he were to lower, or if he were to even stay still underneath probably may what may even need to be a rate hike, I think the long end is super sensitive to that now. I mean, it bounced awfully quick, but we were just down, the TLTs were just down at 83 and change before it bounced back up to TLT. So as far as I'm concerned, that's another new low that in the series of this decline, and I think you'll be blowing through that on the downside at some point. And I think when you do, like I said, it'll create, because clearly a war isn't creating angst. Clearly, locking up the government for 2 months isn't creating enough angst. But I think 100 to 150 basis points on the long end could slow things down for sure.
Well, I talked with another colleague of mine way back in January, and I said if there's one Achilles heel that this whole golden age shtick that the president has been trying to sell has, it's that number one, he never did a darn thing to get the debt under control, reduce the deficits. Now we're going in the wrong direction. Inflation's going back in the wrong direction. And it's his number one nemesis is the bond market vigilantes.
No question about it.
He whines about, well, Powell wasn't lowering interest rates. Why? Well, I'll give you 20 trillion reasons why. That's how much debt your one big beautiful baseball, hot dogs, and apple pie bill adds to the debt over 10 years. The base case, and even a lot of Trump supporters lost this in all of the self-serving mumbo jumbo that came out. The base case of that big bill adds 2 trillion a year more debt. And at
Well,
some point, you got to pay up for that, bond market vigilantes or not. Like you said, a lot of this debt that's already out there is being refinanced. Other countries with worse economies than ours, the ECB is talking about raising rates, as they should be. And I think Warsh gets dragged into that. And a lot of folks don't understand that if he proves to be or gives signals to the market that he's going to be an easy mark like Powell, I'm going to talk about inflation to death, but otherwise, out of the other side of my mouth, deny it, let inflation run hot. We'll go beyond that 6% long bond yield of the 90s if the market sees a whole lot of that, won't we?
well, what also is really interesting, and I mean, there's certain things that you do by yourself, like in your own office, but like there was an opportunity that we had to really take a lot of our debt and move it to like a 20-year duration. And clearly, that opportunity's passed us by now, and now you've got a tremendous amount of our debt on a very short-term duration, possibly even shorter than, say, an ARM on a home in 2007. So I mean, if we misbehave enough, we're going to have to pay a lot more, and that's probably unexpected interest that isn't in that $37 trillion either, that we'll have to pay.
Right. So I think job one for Warsh is going to be that he's going to have to show that he's not an easy mark like Powell. And ironically, and people don't realize this or don't think about it, if the Fed were to be hawkish, let alone start to raise interest rates again, that all else being equal, will keep the long end in check and actually bring long-term borrowing costs down, even though people in that trade will be sniffing out a recession.
Well, I mean, they may be able to control the situation. They may not.
Right.
When you start seeing all of these other sovereign long ends also misbehaving at the same time,
Yeah.
I don't know if it's necessarily in the Fed's, their ability to be able to control everything in life. And there may be a situation where, I see a lot of posts on LinkedIn, and they show the JGB yield that's 30-year chart and how it's swinging up and around.
Right.
And when I see a chart like that, sometimes I just think to myself, that thing is probably going to stop when it breaks something. Like it's
Yeah.
probably not going to stop until something breaks.
Right.
And so I just kind of I, you know, you just kind of feel that things are kind of progressing. People aren't really, as you say, taking it very seriously right now. But I think that it'll move to a shocking position where people will start taking it very seriously.
Well, I think you're right. It's a question of when. I mean, the stock market all of this year has not taken the sticky inflation going back up, the interest rates staying higher. It just hasn't taken it seriously. The easy trade has been to ignore all of that, and it's like I've mentioned so many times, a lot of people who followed the fight game years ago remember who Chuck Wepner was. He was one of Muhammad Ali's opponents later on, and he was a guy who was totally outmatched but stayed on his feet for 15 rounds. Ended up being Sylvester Stallone's really his impetus for the screenplay for Rocky, to see this guy who was unheralded, should have been out of there in a second round. He stayed on his feet, and we continue to marvel at the stock market staying on its feet, but I kind of have to believe that we're getting to toward the 15th round, Brad. And the other thing that astonishingly, the market is not taken seriously. And again, I think there's a lot of hopium out there. There's a lot of wishful thinking, partly because of all of these things coming out of the president from time to time that all, we've ended this war 40 times in the last week with Iran. But a lot of really smart people, from oil company execs themselves to Jeff Currie, who I know one of the smartest commodity guys on the planet, are unanimously saying that we have still not yet seen the full effects of this historic supply shock and how sticky the oil price is going to stay, even if the ceasefire is extended tomorrow, even if this war ended tomorrow. We're getting the tank bottom. Even in this country, in California, I just read that we're about out of jet fuel
Oh
going
yeah,
in.
it's gonna get brutal going forward. But I have something that I thought is really interesting,
Sure.
and I'm not a commodity person, although I definitely have views. You know what I think is really interesting is we clearly are in a period where logistics within side of the energy supply chain is being challenged, and it's gonna be challenged for a little bit, and there's insurance. Premiums to be had, that are gone crazy. And, but look 2 years, look 5 years, look 10 years down the road. It's interesting. You've got Iran, which is one of the largest oil fields in the world, and you've got Venezuela, which is one of the largest oil fields in the world. And both of them are, well, let's say, trying to get liberated. And it would be very interesting if both of those ended up in much more liberal hands going forward. I wonder if they could break the Eagle Ford, like really, like get it down to like $50, because that's a lot of real, like the Venezuela supply is clearly a more expensive, and it's cost more to refine. But if you really solve that Middle East, constant issue or whatever, you could get some pretty low prices, I would think.
Oh, long term, I agree. I mean, Venezuela, a couple of the oil execs early on when Trump.
Guyana is gushing oil. I mean, it's
Yeah.
crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you've got heavy oil down there. We need more refining capacity for sure in this country, as well as elsewhere. But I think long term, you're right. I do believe that if you can get war and conflict out of the equation, and all of these resources in the world that have been tied up or messed up in the more recently straightened out, sure, down the road we can have cheaper oil again. I don't question that.
But on the flip side, you start looking at the reserves and the new oil, the new copper, silver, and gold finds in the world, and there aren't any. They're literally, and all these gold companies, all they're doing instead of getting more reserves is they're just working on their free cash flow. It's really interesting.
Well, there's a long-term play for a lot of these different commodities, a lot of which have been exacerbated, I think, by the Iran war and supply shortfalls. I mean, one of my favorite, most explosive stock stories these days is a company that's got a unique project in the world in northeastern Nevada. It's an organic raw rock phosphate, which you don't need to marry with ammonium or anything. You just need to drill it, blast out, put it in bags, and send it to end users. And
Wow.
fertilizer is a big deal. Copper is a
Sure.
big deal. So we'll see. I mean, I still think that we're going to roll into more of a commodity super cycle because of all of these shortages that we've got. But near term, I'm looking for the stock market to sooner rather than later have to reckon with the fact that before we get to a better world where Middle Eastern energy is flowing, Venezuela's, decrepit industry is rebuilt, et cetera. Canada is an unsung hero. I mean, Canada, whereas the U.S. is in the maybe the seventh or eighth inning of our shale industry, they're still in the second or third inning up there. I think there's going to be a huge M&A wave, in fact, and for some really good Canadian assets. But between here and there, I think that a lot of these earnings estimates going forward don't reckon with the fact that we're going to have high energy prices for a while. I think because of this
Well,
war.
it's funny. If you go back, and I'm not going to say that we're in the summer of 87, but I was an 18-year-old. I owned puts into the crash of 87, and you have a similar setup. You have a very expensive market. You have tremendous amount of individual ownership relative to their assets in their normal account, 20% higher than 2000. You have a similar type valuation. And when you look, or when I look at the forward earnings yield of the S&P 500, so we're at a 22 or 23 on the S&P, reverse that and you're at like a 4.75% forward earnings yield. You add in the dividend, which is less than 1%, and you're less than 6% on your forward earnings yield plus your dividend. Once you get to the point where your 10-year and even 20-year yield is challenging a risk-free rate of return and they're almost at parity, so your risk-free rate of return in your bond market yield is similar to your equity return, which it's an equity return, it should be much higher than the risk-free rate of return. So that's about where it was in 2000, and we saw kind of what happened. So when you see some of these guys like Jeremy Grantham or somebody, and they say, oh, the lost decade's coming, that's what they're looking at. They're looking at the forward earnings yield of what you're buying into, and they're saying, it's looking thin, guys, going forward, which, for me as a hedge fund person, it may not be, let's say, tax efficient, but it's much easier to find your rifle shots with inside of the long short space, because when you do find something like, a short that needs to go down, or I've had an oversized position in Dell for a very long time, but Dell was like a 12 PE stock with price to sales at 1 or 1.5. The market for these mega tech stocks are trading at like 8 times price to sales. 30. So, you could always adjust for like some kind of, catch up between a great large cap that was trading at a discount. But when the whole marketplace is trading at, price to book and forward earnings, dividend yields, and things like that, like they were in 2000, you got to figure that it's a dangerous time just because expectation for forward returns are so high.
Well, they are, and I want to underscore some, one of the items about 1987. I vividly remember that. I remember where I was when I got back in my car the afternoon of October 19th and turned on the news to listen to how much the market had gone down. But one of the big things that knocked the legs out from under the market was a spike in Treasury yields in 87. We
That's
started
right.
the year at 7% on the long bond. By the summer, it was up near 10. Interestingly, back in those days, the main culprit was Japan, which decided they back in those days they were buying a disproportionate amount of our debt. Their bubble hadn't burst yet. That came a couple of years later, and they simply wanted a higher return. And that's what the bond market vigilantes are doing now. Not in as abrupt a way, maybe, as what Japan did in the 80s, but they're all saying, looking at the supply, looking at zero will on the part of the federal government to rein in spending and deficits. Okay, fine, we'll continue to finance you, but it's going to be at a higher rate. And
That's right.
while everybody's been yawning or sleeping or watching something else, we're back to negative yields again. I
Yeah, that's
mean,
right.
the inflation rate is back above the federal funds rate. And even Powell, who was one of the, I used to say that either Burns or Greenspan were the most disastrous policymakers in history, but Powell gave them a run for their money, unleashing all the inflation that he did in his chairmanship. And even by his reckoning, a neutral federal funds rate is 1% or so above the inflation rate. So we shouldn't have a 3 5/8% federal funds rate. It should be 5 right now.
Oh, I mean, when you go back and look at the Fed and really like overlay a chart over like say economic growth, it's somewhat comical to the aggressive nature that they tend to get to when things are moving. In 07, they raised it very aggressively toward the end. It was completely too late. They probably created a lot of 08 that didn't need to occur. Even when you go back and look at the savings and loan crisis, I mean, in 89, it really was a situation where the curve became inverted. And if you remember, and the savings and loans, the way they were set up was they were borrowing a lot of short-term money and owning a lot of long-term assets, which of course never works, but they tried it again anyway, and they got caught. And I just kind of feel like that we're kind of in a similar type of situation. It's gonna show its head somewhere like that.
I think we're regrettably going to head that way. I think you're right. So you've been able to eke out a halfway decent return, even being a short-oriented fund, but again, an actively managed one. Warren Buffett has famously said in the recent past, he's comparing with the greed and the casino environment right now. He's really been more ostentatious about those comments, and he's been since the internet bubble. And I don't think there's people who understand fundamentals that would disagree. The question is, what is it that is finally going to get the attention of people that are chasing these AI and some of the other stocks into the stratosphere? What's going to be their wake-up call? Will it be rates? Will it be energy? Is it going to be something? Ray Dalio made a really good point a few times recently. He said, the fact that we're in a bubble should be undeniable and is undeniable in his view. The question is, what bursts the bubble? The bubble bursts when people need to raise cash, and they do it out of panic. They do it out of, usually not out of valuation. But what is going to cause people to want to raise cash? I mean, there's this chatter right now with SpaceX IPO next week, a couple other high profile ones. We've seen Bitcoin get crushed, people selling it, and it hasn't had apparently that much reverberation yet to get liquid for some other things. Is it going to be the market eating itself and selling some of these overpriced areas for these new
So,
IPOs? What might it be,
so,
Brad?
so, so, so I used to in another time in my life, I was the head technician for a family office in Fort Worth, Texas, the Bass Brothers.
Right.
And we had 20 or 30 different portfolio managers running fundamental strategies that I would be helping them with technically. And sometimes some of these stocks that were supposed pair strategies would get completely out of control and misaligned, and it would stay that way for a while. And I think that sometimes people, as Ray Dalio was saying, you know, the market has been so overvalued that people almost get tired of hearing a Warren Buffett say, you know, the GDP indicator, market cap indicator is so high, and therefore, you know, hogwash, let's buy some AI. I mean, I think that when you're a risk manager, like I am, and you're looking at everything, I'm not a prophet. I don't know what's going to happen. But think of it as a bunch of different risk parameters with inside of a Bollinger Bands, or, you know, some type of bands. And,
sure.
You know, you're going, you know, there is a period where, trees don't grow to the sky and nothing goes to zero. So if you have this movement, the more things that you're stacking up on the upper end of the spectrum, the more concerned you should be. And clearly we've had a valuation problem for quite a while. The market keeps going up. We've had a few unexpected wars and things like that that clearly have created a downdraft, but the market seems to come right back. So clearly, you know, the bull market is somewhat intact for, you know, a reasonably decent amount, layer of names. There clearly has been a layer of names on the flip side that have been in bear markets. I mean, I've shorted a lot of them. I mean, Elf and Lululemon and the cable companies. I mean, clearly it's not a one-way street.
Right.
I think that the multiple expansion that, let me say this differently, the movement up in the market has really been a tremendous expansion in multiple. It hasn't necessarily been a massive earnings miscalculation from, say, estimates a year ago. So people are really banking on this 26, 27, 28 growth story from AI. I think that when you start stacking up a lot of risks and you keep stacking more and more risks up, I'm not saying that that may not happen, but what I am saying is that I think the markets are miscalculating, say, 150 basis points on the long end, what that'll do to housing, what that'll do to margins with all this debt has to get rolled. I just think there's some things brewing that, you know, we're baking in all the good stuff and we're not baking in any of the bad stuff. So when the bad stuff comes, you're moving from a multiple of 22 to 16 very quickly. And that adjustment's, you know, clearly scary, you know, but it doesn't have to be if you're prepared. If you're so, okay, it's going to happen and I want cash and I want to be ready to take advantage of that. And I'm going to, you know, a macro event's occurred and it'll disrupt, you know, everything at once. It's one of those periods where you see everything down one day, not just Bitcoin getting affected, but the Mag 7 still going up. So there's still some rotation going on. We saw some of that today.
Well, for sure. And that belies the fact that there's still a lot of liquidity and a lot of confidence, properly placed or not, in these moves that you're not going to break right away. And back to Dalio's comment, no one's in a major rush right now to raise cash. And you know, which would be something, if they did it big enough, would reveal this bubble for what it is. Winding down, I want to dive deeper into maybe a few more specific portfolio ideas, Brad. And again, you've been able to post a positive return despite these record markets because you pick your spots, you're an active manager. You also have good amounts of cash on hand when you don't like any ideas, and so you want to at least keep your powder dry. But I've listened to some news the other day, and I want to ask your opinion on real estate. You know, I live in Florida, which for a while the market was booming again down here. especially in the wake of COVID. A lot of people didn't like the policies enacted in northern states. So people from New York, New Jersey, et cetera, are flocking. It seems like the whole world's moving to Florida. I mean, I go out and drive around even where I live in North Florida, which is not near as built up as, Miami and those areas. And I think, what did the county legislators pass some bill that you can't have a vacant piece of ground anymore in this county?
That's
Because
aggressive.
stuff's booming. That said, there's not a major market in this state right now, and this is true elsewhere, where you're not down 10 to 15% right now, the valuations off the highs of what they were.
If not more in Florida, some places,
And
yeah.
there are some places that are more than that. And also, it's out in just the last few days that houses are being taken off the market at the fastest pace in quite a long time. So that tells you that not all is well on Main Street. Are there any themes within this really sick real estate market right now that you're looking at to make some money on the short side?
So I've really so I've been a lot more focused on the CMBS in the office than I have residential.
Okay.
To me, CMBS seems, much more vulnerable than residential. Residential, there's a bid for merchandise. It may not be where it was a year or two ago, but it's clearly very well bid. I help someone in Dallas, Texas, with their estate, and we are looking around to move houses. And University Parks is a joke. Like you can't even find a house that's so hot. I think I saw where Highland Park was. The average day on market was like 26 days. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
So I don't, but office is a huge problem, and there's a lot of inventory. There's projects that are owned by a lot of public REITs, and there are a lot of banks that have financed a lot of this stuff. Some of it 5, 10 years ago when it looked more sexy than it is now, but. The CMBS, the commercial default rate market, is well over 10%. So that's as damaged as it was during 08. So, for instance, we're short Ozark Bank. They have one of the highest percent loan books on office relative to their market cap in the entire regional space.
Wow.
I'm trying. So when we're finding things, we're really trying to find, like, it's not something they're going to be able to get out of easily, and it'll take some pain to get out of it. Those are the type of problems where, call me lucky, but I want to be short problems. I want to be short things that can get worse that clearly aren't recognized right now, and that's certainly an area that we're very concerned about.
Well, and commercial mortgages, I mean, that's been a shoe waiting to drop for a while. And every now and then, there's been this news over the last few years where here and there a bank goes under, but they've been absorbed easily. I mean, it hasn't reached critical mass yet, kind of like it did in a different way in 2007, 8, and 9. So you get a whiff of that, though, underneath the surface that's brewing.
Oh, I think it's total. Not only is it brewing, I mean, the lenders and the borrowers at this point are somewhat able to solve problems, but in a very distressed situation, they wouldn't be
Right.
because they would be too far apart. And right now you have record tight spreads, so it makes a problem much easier to deal with than if you had lots of problems you're dealing with all at once. I think that you could find yourself in a position where the banks have lots of positions that are not working, and it's easy to absorb one problem. When you've got 80 problems, it's harder to absorb,
Right.
just one. And I think that that's coming. It's kind of like whack-a-mole right now.
Yeah.
But I mean, a CM, CM, this is the highest CMBS default rate and auto ABS default rate in over 15 years since 08. So
Well, and I was just going to ask you
it's
about the auto
statistically
and the
happening.
more consumer areas too, because you've got high delinquencies on credit cards, high delinquencies on the subprime auto loans, and so forth. There's been a lot of talk about this so-called K-shaped economy, where if you've got a big portfolio of AI stocks, you really do feel the golden age. Everybody else is feeling, like we're in the what we're watching a Grapes of Wrath rerun.
I think that something else is very comical too, and we've started shorting a few of them. But this private credit kind of got scary, and then it went away very quickly. The mantra with inside of private credit. Now I want you to think about this conversation we've had: 8%, 10% default rates on credit cards, auto, blah blah blah. Okay, now you're moving to private credit, and the mantra in that space is the default rate is 1.5 to 2%. How is that even possible? So I mean, they have all sorts of games that they play with the borrowers. They can reset things, they can do things, but clearly there's a lot of expectation that it's going to stay at 2%. My bet is that's something that could move to 6 or 8 pretty easily as well.
I think you're right. And this again, going back to a comment I made earlier about Kevin Warsh, he's kind of between two opposing forces. I don't know if I've sent you this yet, but with a couple of these posts, I'm going to have to include this cartoon since I mentioned it. But I got a great cartoonist, Jerry King, and I had him do a picture, a cartoon of Kevin Warsh. On one side, he's got the bond market vigilante dressed like a cowboy with a gun to his head. On the other side, he's got the Grim Reaper, who is the credit crisis, and talking about all of these cracks underneath the surface. And both of them are threatening to kill him if he doesn't do what he's told. Well, can he do both? He might do one and then the other. That's kind of what I'm looking at. But yeah, at some point, we're back at a situation where maybe it doesn't all happen in one fell swoop like it did in 07 and 08, but all of this credit deterioration, it's been papered over, chewing gum and baling wire and duct tape. Some point it's real.
And I also would like to add that the margin debt in the market is extremely high, and a lot of what was going on coming into the crash of 87 wasn't necessarily valuation, but it was margin calls. And that's when you're not in control of your portfolio. The margin clerk is in control of your
That's
portfolio.
right. And you don't have any choice. They called it portfolio insurance back in
That's
those
right,
days.
portfolio insurance. So look, I mean, it's been a lot of fun on the way up. There's a lot of liquidity right now, but a bad bond market, a lot of margin calls can change things, very fast in this type of thing. So, but we were earlier, we were talking about different stocks and stock selection. And one thing that my partner and I really have gravitated to when we've been shorting, and we've been doing this for over a decade now in the ETF. And when you have a stock that is a P of 15 and it's in trouble and it goes down to a P of 8 or 9, it's going to go down 30%. But when you've got a company that starts out at 20 times price to sales, and it's a good company, and they miss their expectations, it can easily go down to a 5 times price to sales, which, by the way, is still very generous, and still end up down 75% in price. So, I always go back to the crash of 87, and not because I think necessarily that we'll have one this summer, although I do think there's some similarities. But when you have everybody sitting on one side, of the coin, and they're all on margin, sometimes you can get, a movement, to an oversold position that you shouldn't have even gotten to either, because, there's the everyone's so much on one side of the room, you just don't have any, there's no cash left, everybody's on margin. So when you're moving all at once, everybody's doing the same thing all at once.
Well, and that's what causes these big washouts in prices, and it doesn't take a whole heck of a lot of activity. And people find out, you've probably seen a lot of the stuff like I have over time, calling the stock markets like the Hotel California you can check out, but you can't leave. And I always love using graphic portrayals of things. You ever use, Brad, one of those old-fashioned minnow traps that were kind of a mesh thing? And you have for a minnow or a little frog or tadpole an easy way to swim in, but it narrows.
Sure,
And
I don't have one, but I know what you're talking about.
once you're in the trap, how do you get out of it? And that's how you catch the bait, because they figured out how to get in, they can't figure out how to get out. And I just get the sense again that, for people who are way too complacent with what's going on right now, maybe we don't drop big tomorrow or next week or next month, but at some point, the music stops, or all of a sudden you figure out, hey, you got to find out how to get out of this minnow trap. It may not be that easy.
Well, I like I said, I follow the TLTs a lot, and
Yep.
I figure, that it's going to give you an indication when it really starts moving lower and starts declining, and rates start really going up. I mean, there's probably a month or two that you probably have where the liquidity in the market's really draining pretty fast, and your indexes probably don't react. By the time they're selling your indexes, it's kind of like Bitcoin's going to be at 50,000 or 40,000, but by the time the Dow starts correcting.
Could
So
well be.
that's already down quite a bit. So I'm just like, by the time the real selling starts, some of your darlings are already down quite a bit. You're already, down.
Well, Brad, I always enjoy visiting with you because you're not a dogmatic bear. You're a practical one. You know what you're doing, and you're an active manager. So, in closing, give everybody, but you'll do it way better than I can. Kind of your elevator pitch, why they should have a part of their portfolio in HDGE.
I think that we've shown that over time, we're not short the Amazons and the Microsofts of the world. We reduce risk in your portfolio. We don't expect people to hold it all the time. Clearly, when the VIX is at 30 or 40, you're buying. You should be buying, not hedging.
Right.
But when you are looking for a good option, we are a good option. We mark with an NAV at the end of every day, which means we don't have this inverse reset issue. So if we're not doing poorly, it's because of our stock selection, not because of the ETF not doing what we're doing. And short sellers also have been penalized the last 10 or 15 years. Our investors give us a dollar, and then we short, and we're get another dollar. So we have $2 in cash for every dollar we have of shareholders, and that goes into interest. So when interest was to the floor, we tended to get nothing on our cash. Traditionally, over the last, say, 40 years, traditionally you got anywhere between 8 and 10% on all that cash every year, and that helps kind of pad. So it's almost like now you're being paid 8 or 9% a year to be short, which is really the what in the past had always been what people have been given when they took rates to zero, and risk arbitrageurs too, because they get money on their cash when they're doing their merger
And
deals.
you've had a nice distribution yield in the recent past.
Yeah, we're distributing almost 8% in interest every December, and we actually are looking at possibly trying to start putting that out monthly,
Nice.
because, well, our average shareholder holds our position about anywhere from 3 to 8 months, and so we kind of feel like that would be a more fair way to, as a user, to get, their share of the interest instead of maybe missing it in December. So, it's one of those paperwork things that take a while, but
Right. Okay. Well, Brad, great stuff. I'm a big advocate, of course. We've got a healthy position still. Recommended the National Investor to your fund for obvious reasons. And folks, again, in the notes to this podcast, you'll have a link to the website for the fund. Kick the tires, check it out. But again, especially now, I think that this is something where if you're not hedged in some other way, this is a really smart way to do it. Brad, thanks much for your time today, and we'll have you back again one of these days soon.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Nice to be here.
Take care.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to chris@nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.